The subject of the day is meditation. But first of all, I'd like to point out that this is not intended as a criticism or as an exposé or to depreciate in any way the importance of metaphysical, mystical disciplines. It is, however, more or less obvious every day that some of these processes and practices are being abused, others are completely misunderstood, and a number of very sincere and honorable persons have gotten themselves into profound emotional and mental disturbances as a result of trying to practice these disciplines. It therefore seems important to try to help to clarify this particular subject for the benefit of Western people. In the first place, Western man is not by nature a meditating being. It takes almost all the effort he can exert to even try to develop these aspects of his consciousness and his mind. He has approached religion, truth, and God for over 2,000 years almost completely devotionally. And this is very important. But the devotional love of deity has become the approach with which we are familiar and is expressed largely through prayer. Prayer is important. It is vitally important. But technically, it is not the same thing as meditation. Prayer is an approach on a purely devotional basis. And here again, Western people have difficulties. We are not even used to being simply devotional to anything. Well, perhaps we have a certain extreme fondness for ourselves, but it doesn't really reach the standard of true devotion. The individual lives in a physical world, and the rapid development of physical conditions in the Western world has resulted in an almost completely intellectual point of view and has caused us to trust the mind more, perhaps, than we should. Now, the mind is a very useful instrument. But the idea that we are born and endowed with a superlative intellect for no reason and that it will serve us well without any effort on our own part is simply not true. The mind itself, as the Oriental says, can be the slayer of the real. And the intellect has produced most of the miseries that have afflicted the whole world and especially the Western Hemisphere for the last 2,000 years. The actual problem of the intellect has to be carefully considered. Now, we are all born with minds of various specializations and various degrees of development. Any school teacher can point this out to you. Aptitudes in various areas become important in the education of the individual. But the one aptitude that we have not noticed very much of in recent years is the aptitude of meditation. We do not have the basic foundations for a meditative life. In fact, we would be a little afraid to attempt it because it could so easily end in physical hazards and detriments. So in the working with the individual and the person working with himself has to realize that his mind is a specialized instrument. It is peculiarly his own. It has limitations which he has to discover. It can to certain degrees be improved, changed, and modified. The memory can help us to maintain the knowledge of an art or a science, but every mind has its own boundaries, and where we attempt to break through these boundaries, we always find difficulties. For example, we can take specialized talents. An individual who is tone deaf will never do well trying to learn a musical instrument which must be tuned by himself. An individual who has actually little or no sense of composition is not going to be a good artist, no matter how hard he tries. Each individual uses the faculties that he possesses, and these faculties instinctively impel him in one direction or another. He finds, perhaps, that instead of being an artist or a musician, that he is a writer, or that he can be a scientist. It depends not only upon his choice, but gradually upon the ability of his faculties to support his decision. If the mind does not want that specialty, it's going to be very hard to be successful in attaining advancement in the field, that field of learning. Now, in also very often a case to realize that people on various levels of thinking have bodies, minds, and emotions brought together in a happy pattern. There are persons who will live their entire lives in a kind of natural affection. They will love their friends, their children, they will enjoy pets, they will work for a harmonious home, and over every other consideration is this desire for a gentle, constructive, happy relationship with life. Others are dominated by ambitions, and the pressure of the mind leads them sometimes into tragedy. Everywhere we turn, we find that the mind of the person fits with the body that he inhabits. His mind sort of goes with his total personality and is the basis of it. His mind tells him about what he ought to be doing, how he should think, what he can accomplish, and how he can enrich his life. Now, there are differences in persons, but these differences are not necessarily advancements or deficiencies. The individual who loves flowers and wishes to be a botanist is doing just as well as someone else who wishes to go into astronomy or mathematics. The natural aptitudes of the person must be considered. If he goes against them, his health suffers. His career is apt to be frustrated. And if the frustration is sufficient, he may become neurotic or even psychotic because he is a square peg in a round hole. He doesn't fit into the life he has assumed, therefore it brings him no true satisfaction and no happiness. This is because the mind will not support it. It does not fit into the career the person has selected. Now, because the mind has this power, the problem of educating it requires a very wise advance in technologies. We can use the mind to educate us and ourselves and each other, but to find the proper internal chemistry so that the mind becomes the natural, happy, healthy leader of the life and guardian of the health and protector of happiness. These achievements require considerable consideration. Now, we have another point here that is very important, and that is the grand scheme of the life way with which we are involved. At this particular time in the life of Western peoples, everything is extremely stressful. Competition is intensive. And the individual uses the mental faculties improperly. He uses them improperly because he feels that he must, that there is no way of achieving the success or security that he wants without using his mind to advance his fortunes. Therefore, first thing we know, he begins to cause the mind to become ill. The mind is uncomfortable and unhappy. It cannot properly guard the body over which it has a certain rulership. It cannot make the life full of achievements that are natural to the heart's desire. And the mind gradually becomes a hazard. It breaks homes. It destroys optimism and integrities, leads to corruption and crime, and ultimately can destroy a nation or an individual. With this type of thing, it becomes obvious that certain special methods have to be used if we want to have the spiritual benefits of right thinking. We have tied meditation very closely with religion, sometimes with mystical philosophy, but it mostly has to do with something about the inner life, and exactly the definition of it, in fact, is very difficult. We are not at all able to define it because in each person its function is different. There are variations, if no more possible to impose one formula of mental growth upon an individual than it is to give every person who lives the same antibiotic pills. Each individual must explore himself. So I think perhaps we begin the processes of meditation not by a discipline, but by a survey. We begin to think about what we need, what we really want to accomplish of permanent good, how much our idealism is going to be strengthened, to what degree we may come into complications as the result of our decisions, and all in all, what is the mind going to do to help us if we wish to use it in a meditational way? Well, of course, meditation implies quietude. It implies the individual no longer beset by internal mental instability. In other words, as one scholar said some years ago, the mind can no longer be considered merely a tumbling ground for whimsies. But with many people it is. Many people make up their own mental lives without any consideration for the mind's needs or attitudes. Some allow it to become the basis of a frivolous relationship with life. It becomes a doctrine of or a teacher in fallacies, in abuses, misuses, and irresponsibilities. But most of all, the mind, left to itself, will behave itself reasonably well if the life in general is governed by common sense. The mind will cooperate with the normal attitudes of the person. It can do this quietly, peacefully, and cooperatively. But when the attitudes of the person become confused, then the mind is at a disadvantage. Therefore, the normal function of the mind of the human being demands a normal life in which the human being uses his faculties, powers, and abilities as nature intended him to, and not as the programs for success and affluence have impelled him to attempt. If the person is normal, the mind will be pretty reasonable. It will take care of itself and it will help the individual to live. The mind in the normal person is a happy mind. It is a constructive factor. It is at peace with itself. It accepts itself as that self is, and it is constantly impelling to minor but valuable constructive idealistic impulses. So if this is not the case with the person, and he is, for instance, seeking some form of religion that is going to improve his own inner life, it is time for him to consider what this inner life is. Now, some systems of meditation advise the person to reduce the mind to a blank. Later we'll say why we don't really believe that is best. But if we can release the mind from stress and pressure and allow it to be quiet, if the inner life of the person, the life that surfeits in sleep, in dreams, the life that causes anxieties and causes responsibilities to become enormous, the life which is competitive, has grievances with others, is subject to jealousy and greed, that is gossipy and hateful. If these things are in the individual's construction at the moment, it is going to be impossible for him to approach deity successfully until he corrects his own faults. In other words, before he can go into a mystical way of life, he must take care of the common faults of daily living to the best of his ability. An effort to do this conscientiously is a proof of sincerity. The person who is willing to change for the better and give up things which perhaps he has enjoyed because they were not good for him, this individual is sincere. And the beginning of wisdom is sincerity. It has to come first. So you can take yourself and see what would be necessary in order to have a quiet, benevolent, peaceful, cheerful relationship with your own thinking. If your thinking is constantly negative, if you're constantly fearing something, if your anxieties and antagonisms are rising to every emergency, and if the common affairs of life are nothing but interruptions to what you want to be doing, then go to work on the mind. And this people have done since the time of Pythagoras. The contemplative disciplines of Pythagoras were not the type of meditation we think of today. Retrospection was a process of going back over the daily life and finding out what the mistakes were and what the consequences of those mistakes were. This retrospective exercise helps the individual to control himself. It places him in an educational relationship with his own thinking. He begins to see the things that he paid no attention to before. Sometimes when he said something unpleasant, he just wanted to forget it and laugh it off and keep on being unpleasant. But retrospection will gradually show him that this will cost him his friends, his job, his family, and his own self-respect if he does not correct it. So retrospection was putting the life in order, restoring the validity of natural law over human conduct. Retrospection brought the individual to know what the universe intended him to be. It doesn't necessarily make him that immediately, but it discovers for him what his own potential actually can be. The contemplative exercises of the Pythagoreans were of a different note. Contemplation was a form of concentration. Contemplation was a search for meaning in things. Contemplation might cause the thoughtful person to sit quietly in his garden and allow the flowers to speak to him, at least in a symbolic way. Contemplation was the looking out for value. It was to get beneath the surface of things that appear superficial and find out the reason for them. Contemplation also helped to put things in order. It helped the individual to gradually gain spiritual strength. The final contemplation is the contemplation of life itself, which in its own way gives us a new sense of relationship with divinity and our fellow man. Concentration was another discipline which was taught by the ancient Greeks. This was very good because it helps the person to achieve continuity in his own effort. The individuals who are scattered in their thinking, who stop many things and finish few of them, individuals who get tired of something very quickly or begin to cast it aside because it becomes increasingly difficult. Where concentration is lacking, the person does not have any depth of purpose. He does not know how to unfold his own faculties. Lack of concentration can make a bad student in school and make a bad housewife, a bad businessman, and a dangerous leader in society. So concentration is to stay with it until you finish it. And if you don't want to finish it, don't start it. Because to go halfway along and give it up for something else, or move from one sect to another in religion, or from one level of belief to another without having conquered anything, without having fulfilled any essential purpose, the discontinuance of action because it becomes increasingly difficult. This is a discipline the Pythagoreans were very fond of. They like to get this discipline of continuity, that everything must be done to the proper end, for it is only when the complete pattern is revealed that the law is evident in the particular task that has been assumed. Now, these were the disciplines of the Greeks, and to a large degree, they were finally found their way into Neoplatonic philosophy, and with certain reservations and changes into the Gnostic doctrines. These combined both Eastern and Western thinking. But they constituted a method, more or less Western, a method which could be organized, it could be rationalized in one way or another, and might bring the individual gradually into a state of self-sufficiency, self-security, and make the individual capable of running his own life effectively. Now, on the other side of the meditative problem, we come upon the Asiatic approach. Asia is the other side of a great coin. And the other side, in this case, means that the Eastern Hemisphere has been, from the very earliest times, more associated with inner life, inner dedications, and the development of internal resources than Western man. The Eastern thinker is concerned with what he is. The Western thinker is more apt to be concerned with what he has. Now, the Orient has produced many different systems of religion and, in a sense, magic. Because in the Eastern systems, Tantra and things of this nature come into a strange combination of religion and transcendentalism. But the one gradually evolving fact that we perceive is that it's quite impossible to say that all of any nation represent the best part of that nation. There are just as many mistakes in Asia as there are here, but they are different mistakes. And unfortunately, we are teaching them ours. But they're getting it a little back of us because they are giving us some of their mistakes also. And this interchange is especially complicated in matters of religion. Religion, basically, is at the foundation of nearly all efforts of the human being to grow. Religion has been with us since the beginning of known history. It goes back beyond any measure of time that we possess on the earth and its cycles. But religion basically has as its one primary purpose that man shall come into harmony with the divine plan of which he is a part. Religion is the veneration of deity and the veneration of those principles which we associate with the will of deity. So religion becomes very important. But to the measure that the individual develops external interests, to the same degree he is inclined to weaken his religious principles. Instead of having perfection of the inner life as its ultimate goal, Western man has been inclined to view this life as transitory. Many of the most successful from the standpoint of economic progress do not even believe in a deity or the immortality of the human soul. It is all tied to a fulfillment of ambition and appetite right here in this life. Now, such an individual in that condition is a very poor candidate for esoteric disciplines. even if he attempts them, about the only things can accomplish is to misuse them. So with the East, however, up to very recently, and still to some degree it remains, the child from birth lived in a world recognized as permeated by a very lofty and wonderful relationship between existing things and the sources of existence. The deities were very important to the child mind in the East. The parent was, of course, the example. And where the family was firmly religious and held its principles, even though these principles might disagree with our convictions, that conviction of theirs was passed on down from one generation to another, and the child inherited the family wisdom with its mother's milk. This condition meant that by the time the child was 10 or 12 years old, and the problems of adjustment to social responsibility began to take shape, there was a strong reservoir of integrities in the term of the faith of the family. Also, the community held that faith. Religion was important in the life of the people, and those of simple station who had no great ambitions but expected to remain farmers or artisans for the rest of their lives and for many generations, this simple religious conviction pattern provided an all-sufficient guide to protect the individual from his own shortcomings and preserve him in the faith with which he was born. Now, among these Indian faiths, the greatest of all points in life was that the individual should regain his spiritual awareness of his relationship with truth, with reality, and with God. It was assumed that he would be doing the things he had to do. He would start in life. He would have debts. The very debt of birth would hang over him. These debts he must pay. So the first thing, perhaps, that we can take as a background in the Oriental approach is fulfillment. Religion was the fulfillment of duty. No religious person who wanted to be considered religious would be out to evade the normal burdens of living. He was supposed to achieve the lesser before he assailed the greater. So the individual started life in debt. He was in debt to his parents, who had brought him into this world. He couldn't pay them, because it's quite possible that by the time he got into a condition where he could have repaid them, they weren't here any longer. He could honor their memories, he could respect the things they had done, but he could not pay his parents for what they had given him. But he could balance the debt by bestowing the same virtues in the training of his own children. As he was born, he had been given an opportunity for birth. It was therefore his duty to give other souls their opportunity for birth. So he paid his debt to his parents by becoming a parent and filling all the duties and responsibilities of parenthood. He also fulfilled the social problem of work. Every normal person must make a contribution in support of the cost that he is to the world in which he lives. It isn't only the financial problem. It is the earth that gives him bounty. It is the air, the sea, flowers, birds, everything contribute to his well-being. Therefore, he has a duty to perform, and that is to make a religion of contributing to the well-being of all that lives. There was no virtue in running away from it, no strength in escape. The real path was to work until the work was finished. And when that work is finished and the individual has made every duty a fulfilled responsibility, then he may think of himself a little more. Only afterwards, never before. And in thinking of himself, perhaps he will choose to go into a religious life. Because after he has finished with the duties of this world, it is his proper duty, in the terms of his philosophy and his religion, to prepare himself for that which lies beyond the grave. He should not go into the other world completely unequipped. He should not be able to wonder what is going to happen to him. He should be firm in the realization that a good life and a proper dedication will prepare him for transition, and that then comes the problem of becoming accustomed in his own mind to transition, so that the fear of death no longer perturbs him in any way. It is only another step in the unfoldment of the great picture. It is only another degree in the evolution of human life. Having come to these conclusions, this individual might be said to be a being adjusted to a contemplative life, adjusted to what might be termed meditation, which is actually the individual's ability to use the inner resources of his life in a constructive manner. Now, if the mind is trying to do what is right, and the individual who has it jogs it along with all kinds of compromises and delinquencies, the mind, which is not a spirit in itself, but is a kind of a genie kept in a bottle, the mind says, all right, you want $1 million? I'll help you get it. And the mind will favor us in almost everything we want. But in the end, those kind of favors which the mind bestows are not permanent, have no essential significance, and when the great time comes when the individual must leave this world, he goes utterly unprepared and probably frightened to death. So he can make the mind do as he pleases. He can sign a pact with it as Faust signed a pact with Mephisto. But in the end, it will end in tragedy, because the mind is then being used improperly, because the individual has attitudes that are basically improper themselves, and he wants the mind to help improve them. This is why all different kinds of schools of thought can be proven by dedicating the mind to the acceptance of reports, opinions, and beliefs. The mind can cause us to accept a philosophy and fight to the death to defend it, when in substance there's nothing to it in the first place. So the mind is tricky. And in an effort to get this trickiness out of it, we must stop abusing it and use it as it was intended. So the process of the religious dedication in life finally becomes the fulfillment of a life pattern in which everything the individual has done all through the years strengthens the integrities which he wishes to expand or enlarge. It becomes a new way and a fuller way of growing the next step towards relationship with the infinite. Now, after you get these thoughts in mind, you pick up the book of somebody and you read about a very special discipline which very much remind me of these discipline things sometimes are very similar to diets. Everyone you get is the perfect one. If you want to reduce, there are 17,000 ways of doing it. But in the final analysis, all of these different paths and ways and so forth are simply excuses for something. Their validity is only to the degree that they are supported by the quiet mind and the peaceful heart. There can be no value in any exercise of a religious nature which does not conform with the daily dedications of the person. The integrities must come first. The individual is not going to become spiritual through the disciplines, but his spirituality can make the disciplines possible. It is a different approach from what we are accustomed to. So when you think you've found a nice new way to get better and better, quicker and quicker, it is a good plan to sit down for a moment and say, do I deserve it? Am I trying to do this in order to advance my real life, or am I trying to evade some present responsibility that I don't enjoy? Anyone who is neurotic and takes on disciplines is going to get in trouble. Trouble comes where they are used as substitutes for integrities, where the individual really believes that by keeping quiet for half an hour, all the sins of his life will be forgiven, has missed the point, because all the virtues of his life are the only things that make that half hour important. And longer periods of meditation are, for the most part, escape mechanisms. They are the individual trying more and more to escape from the consequences of his own thoughts, emotions, and conduct. He is trying to get away from the self that is himself and change it for a divine self which he hopes lurks somewhere in the background. But if he does not make the adjustments first, the whole program is frustrated. Meditation, like prayer, is an expression of a devout and dedicated heart. Without that first, there will be no consequences worthwhile. Yet the mind can convince us of anything. The mind can convince us that these things are important just as much as it can convince us that we should all learn French. These things are part of mental attitudes, the result of our own thinking patterns. So we can support a meditative discipline but with the mind, and yet at the same time never have the facts of the matter. We can follow the exercises prescribed by some writer or in some book, but these exercises do not touch the realities. They do not get beyond the mental lock with which we have bound ourselves to a way of life that is not constructive or useful or valuable to us. All these outer things only become offerings brought to the altar of our deity. We bring the flowers of our noble works. We bring the fruit of our dedications. We bring the prayers of our lips and the meditations of our hearts. But they are only gifts that we bring. We have to earn them ourselves. We have to do the things in the way that they should be done. Now, the whole theory of meditation is essentially the realization that if we become normal enough inside ourselves, if we dispose of everything that is artificial, that which remains is reality. Now, the idea of making the mind a blank is not what we are supposed to be doing. The moment we do this, we open ourselves to psychic phenomena, which can become a very blind alley. And it can cause all kinds of self-delusions. And a great many persons suffer bitterly from the fact that they overestimate their own degree of spirituality. They think they are doing it right. They believe that they are serving truth. They are convinced that the system that they are following is God-ordained. But in the long run, they end in a neurotic tangle, very often incurable. So it is very much more to the point to recognize that we are not trying to make the mind a blank. What we are trying to do is to bring the mind to the point where it has already disposed of its own mistakes very largely. The mind used in connection with meditation can hallucinate tremendously if it hasn't been cleansed first. It can dramatize things we have read, things people have told us, ancient symbols until there is no end to what it will do in flooding us with various misrepresentative elements. But when the mind is right, it does not do this. It remains quiet and at peace, and allows something else to gradually take over. Behind the mind, as we know it in our daily thinking, we have the higher structure of the human being. The principles, the divine part of nature, the mind's higher aspects, the soul, the spirit, and its relation to the cosmos, all these things lie above the level of the mind. But the mind can gradually be relaxed to the point that the individual can appreciate or perceive or reflect upon some of these higher principles. But these higher principles are also masked by all kinds of pseudo-psychical phenomena. The only safe answer to the whole problem is that the person must have cleansed the mind before he can depend upon it. The mind can be a servant of reality, but it can also be a servant of delusion. If the individual has not properly balanced his own sense of values, the mind will keep on helping him cheat himself. It will continue to confront him with the delusions of his own believings and of the sects, creeds, and groups with which he has been associated. He cannot achieve his final purpose until he transcends the illusions of life. Now, on the other hand, nature has its own peculiar way of doing things. The individual who frustrates nature simply because he believes frustration is a virtue is also headed into trouble. He is not supposed to go contrary to the simple laws of life. Religion is a fulfillment, not a frustration. The individual does not gain his ends by suffering the loss of the things he likes. Rather, he gains his ends by enjoying the things he has learned to know are best. He is not giving up something he cherishes. He is giving up a false belief and placing a true one in its stead.